Limark TechNet tonight at 8 o'clock. This is the W2VL repeater.
Next time.
Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is AC2GS, and my name is Roy, and I am net control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. Limark Technical Net has been going strong about 44 years now. Happy birthday to it. Every Sunday night at 8 o'clock, we sit in front of our radios and inform each other and learn from each other and entertain each other, hopefully, as well. And I thank you for doing that on a regular basis, and I thank you for coming back tonight when we're going to try and do it all over again. I will tell you the links. Okay. If you want to reach me via email, that would be for mailbag questions, questions normally asked during the technical net, but you can't reach the repeater. Or if there is a topic for discussion that you'd like to hear or be part of or be the entire person doing it, or if you have a puzzle, we're always looking for interesting puzzles about anything, amateur radio certainly, but physics, electronics, all kinds of things. So if you think you have an interesting puzzle for us, email it to me, and I'll take a good look at it. Also, if you have something NASA or space-related and you want to get it to Paul, you can email him directly. His email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. But for all of the above, if you want to email me, I'll give you two email addresses. One is mailbag@ac2gs.com, and the other is roy@limarktech.net. We offer a link page of interesting articles and YouTubes and all kinds of things that I noticed in the previous week. I cut and pasted and put it up on a link page and share it with the rest of you. You can get there by typing into your browser roy.ac2gs.com or links.limarktech.net. We have a chat room. It was very popular last Sunday when the repeater, when the Glen Oaks repeater went down. So let's see if we can rustle up some more people. You can get there by typing into your browser chat.ac2gs.com or chat.limarktech.net. We offer an audio stream of this technical net. We started it purely as an 8 to 11 thing, but some people asked if I could keep it live. So it's kind of an audio stream of the Glen Oaks repeater. You can reach that by typing into your browser, technet.ac2gs.com or stream.limarktech.net. And, of course, I always like to remind people that MikeKC2NJI has a great archive site. It's called amateurradio.tv. It has archives of the Limark Technical Net that go as far back as September of 2006. So avail yourself of the wisdom of people who've either moved away or become, unfortunately, silent keys over the years. That's the links. Let me drop for a second, and I'll tell you what I got planned. Okay. Regular session as per always. About AI, because that seems to be a thing in the news all the time. Then we will ask for questions and topics for discussion. I would like the first few to be amateur radio related, because this is an amateur radio net. But, I mean, we're open to discuss any aspect of science and technology, as you all should know by now. So I'll ask you to hit the push to talk, give me your first name, your call sign, whether a comment or a topic for discussion or a question. And that should take us to approximately 10:15, hopefully. Paul, WS2N, will bring us the SpaceNet report until about 11 o'clock, and I will return and tie a bow on top of it and wish you all a good week. Hopefully, we'll be able to accomplish it this week. We weren't able quite to do that last week because of technical difficulties with the Glen Oaks repeater. Apparently, the circuit breaker failed, and we lost power to very important components in Glen Oaks. Which kind of stopped the tech net and it's you know, it just stopped it. Anyway, let me drop for a second and I'll say my two cents worth with artificial intelligence in the news, because it always seems to be in the news. If you been staying tuned to the regular news? There's a bunch of AI stuff. Those wacky guys at OpenAI have teased people that GPT, which is I think at 4.5 at this point, they're priming 5.0. So gosh darn, who knows what kind of nonsense we're going to have to deal with the GPT 5.0. And another AI company called Anthropic has their own AI. It's called Claude, and they announced Claude 3.0. And the big thing in the news apparently the last week was robotic companies and OpenAI kind of got together, and they wired the robot into the OpenAI, and they have it putting away dishes and cups and such and handing out apples. So we're getting ready for robots to take over the world. So that's kind of the AI for this past week. I'm sure there will be other AI next week and the week after, onward and onward. Anyone with any comments before we get to the regular question segment? Okay, I'll assume that's a polite no. So we will open the gates for any questions of a technical nature tonight. If you got any topics for discussion, if you have any comments, if you discussed some technical thing months and months ago and you finally got to try it out and got results and you want to report back, please do. We're open for business. Please, hit that push to talk. Give me your first name and your call sign. Golly gosh, I don't know what to make of that. You know, unfortunately, due to last week, usually when there's just silence, then means there's something wrong. So we'll try once again. We're open for business. If anyone has any questions or comments to make tonight, please hit that push to talk.
WA2VDH with a question regarding tantalum capacitors.
Okay, John, I put you on the list. Anyone else?
AC2FHO.
Okay, John, we'll put you on the list. Anyone else want to go on the list? Okay, very good. We're not off to a good start. My iPad seems to have crashed, so at some point in the future, I guess I'll have to reboot it. Anyway, first up, WA2VHD. John, what's your question, Zach?
Okay, fine, busy. Yeah, that's WA2 Victor David Henry. Has to do with tantalum capacitors and their failure modes. Last 2 weeks, I've been troubleshooting Fluke Gigatronics signal generator, 6062 Fluke signal generator, and finally traced the problem down to a short in the negative 15 supply. And it turned out to be a little tantalum capacitor went dead short and caused the minus 15 regulators to go into current limit and a whole lot of other little nasty things. Anyway, my question had to do with the structure of tantalum capacitors. Exactly, I think they are polarized. Maybe this is something I could get some other comments about. I believe they are polarized, like electrolytics, in that you can't reverse polarity on them. My question has to do more with their structure, how they're made, and essentially how they differ from electrolytics. So that's really my question. I'd like to hear comments about.
Okay. I'm probably not the best person to ask about. They are electrolytic in nature. They don't tend to use the same liquid material that most of our electrolytic capacitors do, and they usually overheat and explode and vent. The tantalums don't have any liquid in them, and they don't have a vent opening. So although they operate as an electrolytic, it's a different type of situation. Most electrolytic capacitors, as most people know, a current is placed initially that anodizes a non-conducting layer on the plates, and that's the insulator that serves the function of the dielectric. And so you got to be very cautious, and over time the dielectric can dissipate. That's also why people sometimes are able to reform electrolytic capacitors. But tantalum seems to be a particularly weird little thing in that it's a solid-state electrolytic version of a capacitor. Anyone with some of tantalum capacitors, please feel free. Gosh, I gather that there's either no one with any particular expertise in tantalum capacitors or would rather have someone else talk about them. I'm not exactly sure what really pertinent things about tantalum are useful, except as I mentioned before that they seem to be a heck of a lot sturdier than the standard electrolytic capacitors that we know and hate. Once again, just for the heck of it, if anyone out there has any expertise, particularly in tantalum capacitors, and would like to lend their knowledge, please feel free. Well, John, I think we rolled snake eyes tonight on this subject. I'm sorry.
But no problem. Yeah, I was just curious. If anybody had any other experiences. I know years ago I was troubleshooting something with, and it had an electrolytic capacitor, and the end seal blew out on me and scared the living bejesus out of me. So I don't think tantalums can do that, but I know they do. I know they are polarized, and that they do have a definite polarity. But okay, thanks. I appreciate the time on it. I'll be listening for the comments. Okay, thanks, Roy.
Okay, very good, John. Also, there are wet tantalum capacitors in addition to the dry form that I think we're most familiar with, at least I am. Well, maybe we'll circle down that if someone with some expertise starts to feel talkative. I guess we'll just move on to John. Welcome back, John. I hope everything's going well for you out there.
Good evening, Roy. To the people on the net. Well, my question this evening, we're taught that self-cancellation is the right term. Opposing an opposite wave will cancel out. Question is, what's actually happening with physics when this happens? Once we transmit, say you get a multipath and a cancellation, what actually happens? And the source would be a short circuit, and what's happening in the air when these two waves are here at the same moment and place and time and opposite? So is there an energy dump? Is there some kind of heating? What's actually happening there, Roy?
Okay, that's a real interesting thought. There's different ways to kind of describe the phenomena of positive and negative interference. Electromagnetic waves are excitations in the electromagnetic field in space-time, and if you have two signals that hit a certain environment, they cancel each other out. But I would assume that since the good old conservation of energy, that the energy cannot be created and nor destroyed, even though the two differing cancel each other out, I would assume that the energy equation would require the energy to dissipate in some non-electromagnetic form, thermal energy, kinetic energy, something like that. It's something that I really think I got to look up, though. But my gut feeling is because of the nature of conservation of energy laws that they can't just kind of zero themselves. You have energy that's going in one direction. You have energy going in the other direction. I can't see how you could end up with no energy at all. So that would be my guess, that you would, the two electromagnetic waves would interact with whatever environment, because electromagnetic waves by themselves don't do any interaction. You need a medium to kind of demonstrate how interference works. So I would think that it gets translated into some translational kinetic energy of a kind.
And the other thought, maybe, as you were talking, I guess I'm thinking further about it, those opposing waves actually enter your antenna and make it all the way, that where the cancellation is actually happening. In other words, is there really not a cancellation airwaves, or is it happening in transposed, if you will, to the antenna?
Again, my gut feeling is that electromagnetic waves in free space, in the vacuum of space, do not interact. But any kind of physical thing can act as a medium in which they interact. And the first thing that they're going to interact with is the metal conductor of an antenna. So I would assume that this conversion from electromagnetic to thermal takes place on the antenna itself. It doesn't. I can't make a good case for why it should remain, kind of opposite, but same magnitude type of thing all the way down the line. I think as soon as it reaches a conductor with valence electrons, that's where the whole thing goes kaput.
Good, and look it up some more and see what I can read about it. It's one of those thoughts you have, you know, I guess we'll call them shower thoughts, right? When you go, wonder what's happening there. All right, Roy, I guess that's to think about. But, okay, Joe, back to you.
Well, you're welcome, John. You always come up with interesting questions, and sometimes I don't have a clue. I'm going to have to take a good long look at that, because I mean we've all seen interference patterns, the slit lamp experiment. So that's a I got to look that up. The odd thing is with slit lamps, I don't think there's thermal production. I think somehow the energy is just bunched up in particular packets along the material, so it'll be interesting. I'll have to take a good strong look at what's going on there. But thank you, John. Anyone with any having tonight?
VDH with a comment.
Sure, VDH.
I was just thinking in terms of that interference, like if you considered a directional coupler, like say a waveguide coupling to another waveguide in a directional coupler, where it would radiate out through one port, you know, propagate through one port of the waveguide, but not through the other port, because you are getting field cancellation. Or in the same way, if you had a pair of phased verticals that are, you know, a quarter wave apart, and you're driving them 90 degrees out of phase, you'll get cancellation in one direction and reinforcement in the other direction. So I guess that the fields are actually canceling out. You're actually getting cancellation of the fields in one direction and reinforcement in the other. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'll give you that. But the problem that I'm having is it's kind of easy to understand the positive reinforcement. You have two energy streams that are in phase with each other, and they add up additively, and the laws of conservation of energy are withheld. But in the case of a phase inversion of one energy stream that started out identical, you would have negative interference. You would have no electromagnetic energy to speak of, and so the energy conservation equations are completely crazy. That the point that John makes brings up is what happened to the energy that you put into the destructive interference? Did you destroy it? Did you violate the laws of conservation of of energy, or is there something more subtle going on?
Well, I don't think it could be destroyed. It's just that now it's all going in the direction of reinforcement. Just take a pair of phase verticals a quarter wave apart and being driven 90 degrees out of phase. So you're going to fire in the direction of the lagging antenna. So you'll get reinforcement that way, and in the other direction you'll get cancellation. So as far as the energy, what would have gone uniforming now is going mostly in the direction of reinforcement. I think it might have something also to do with superposition, where just like in a circuit where you can superpose voltages and superpose current, but you can't superpose power. You might look at it that way. Go ahead.
Yeah, it certainly is an interesting topic. Ultimately, nothing is 100% efficient. So there's some thermal loss no matter what for anything that you do. Anytime you have things interact, you have some degree of thermal loss. I wonder what the percentage is, what's the theoretically highest efficiency of phase related interference, positive and negative, is, if there's some kind of actual equation that tells you that the maximum efficiency for theoretical efficiency for a system like that is 87.32 or some random number that I just pulled out of the air. So I'm going to have to take a look at it, but again, I think it's kind of easy and simple to say some of it is just thermal loss, because almost any interaction of energy with matter ends up producing some thermal loss. Again, nothing is 100% efficient in our non-theoretical world.
Yeah, it is an interesting question. It is a fascinating question. When it comes down to the conservation of energy, some of these questions, they really get very, very interesting. They get very deep very fast.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this could be very well a rabbit hole. I mean, it depends on how deep into the rabbit hole you want to get. And I try not to do that too often. I hope I don't bore people with yammering about relativity and quantum mechanics. But, it's an interesting thing. I am going to kind of look through the books. It's sort of amazing the different kind of things that come up on, say, technical nets and such, where you Google it and you search, and for the life of you, you don't have the faintest idea where it is. I will unfortunately bring up something I probably brought up too many times before. Me and Dick, may rest in peace, used to talk about near field and far field electromagnetic waves, and the way that magnetic fields are induced and electric fields are induced would suggest that at least in the near field, for 90 degrees out of phase, that's called quadrature. Yet, electromagnetic waves that propagate for many, many miles are in phase. They're not in quadrature. So somewhere between the near field, where a lot of things quadrature suddenly become locked in step and synchronous. I looked and looked and looked, and finally I found some guy's PhD thesis that suggests a solution to the problem. But it's not like there's a simple answer that any physicist is willing to make on the subject. But, maybe I'll find a simple answer to this question by Googling. Or I can always ask GPT. That would be fun to see what kind of thing he makes up. Anyway, thanks, John. Anyone else with any questions or topics or comments tonight? Yes, Wesley?
A new development. Italian company successfully tested magnetic levitation tech on a regular railway track. So imagine that you have a regular railway, and instead of the train, you have something that is right now tested as a train. It weighs 2,000 pounds and moves with a speed of 0.3 miles along 2 kilometer stretch of railway in the Venice. Maglev technology that establishes a cushion of air that physically separates the vehicle from the track, resulting in reduced friction, noise, and vibration. What is new about it is that usually there were attempts to create, let me jump up. There was an attempt to create something like cryogenic cushion. If you remember, Lexus years ago have made a sort of board that the kid could stand on it. I don't know how you call it. And it was moving, but nobody knew that below there was metal and there was a cryogenic cold. This thing is using the regular railway, and theoretically the speed could reach the speed of the airplane. I believe it is something. It doesn't need to be a tunnel like Mr. Musk was trying to develop or anything like that. It is just a regular vehicle on it. From what I've seen here, it is a specially designed infrastructure to generate the magnetic field interacting with onboard elements, facilitating load suppression in the typical Maglock devices. And here there is nothing special. It is just... It says in here that the Iron Lab, which is the name of it, is developing another device that is a motorized trolley with a, that will be able to carry on 20 tons at speed of 200 kilometers per hour, which would be 130 miles per hour. I'm not sure if any of American trains is right now moving with that speed. You know better probably. The company has also started implementing its technology in practical application, utilizing it for movement of heavy windows, elevators, and transporting loads with industrial settings. So I believe this that's kind of news that is very much promising. But
say again?
November 2, Zulu Charlie.
Yes, November 2, Zulu Charlie.
Yeah, I didn't want to interrupt here. I just wanted to get in line for the questions. I wasn't able to. Use Echo Link sometimes you're not able to break in. So just put me in your roster.
Okay, very good. Consider yourself put in the roster. Wesley, the problem is that for every successful technology, there's about 1,000 different tweaks, adjustments, versions, what have you, that never make it past research and development. The problem with magnetic levitation is how are you doing the magnetic levitation? And the answer usually tends to be you're using superconductors. So that kind of adds a large pain in the backside to engineering feats, because you can't use the ceramics, you got to use the metals. The metals work at colder temperatures than the ceramics. And then how do you maintain the temperatures over the long haul? If you get a failure in your superconductor, you'll have a disastrous collision back on the track. So I don't know exactly what technology tweak they're applying this time, but a lot of times countries have figured out that their gee whiz inventive, faster than a speeding bullet trains are overpriced and underutilized and mostly a public relations ploy to show other countries how advanced they are. I think, unfortunately, if a lot of industry kind of focused on diesel electric trains, we have a lot cheaper, cleaner types of transportation. But I'm not a particularly familiar with this technology that you're alluding to tonight.
I got this message not a long time ago. It was everywhere in news because the technology was also published in Reuters, and whenever Reuters is involved, that is something that is legit. It looks like legit. So that was so the Reuters article was from March of 2024. And it says that this technology differs from existing maglev technologies, which typical technology has coils made of conducting material with high infrastructure cost when compared to traditional railway track. So of competitors have carried tests on specific tracks built to accommodate a magnetic levitation vehicle, and that company demonstrated that the vehicle can levitate on the existing track. When they talk about elevators and eventually trolleys that could carry on a few tons or 20 tons of material per one, and then you have many of them, then it looks like it's better utilization of the truck by itself. And eventually, I'm not sure how soon they would be able to implement it to the regular train. For curiosity, do you know what is the maximum speed of American trains?
Offhand, no. I don't. I assume it depends upon the underlying technology. If they're operating like old-fashioned trains that are just running on rails versus maglev that have negligible friction and they're elevated slightly. I just want to touch upon one thing. I don't like when kind of people use journal, newspaper or news agencies as the kiss of truth. News agencies almost always get things wrong. I'm sure Reuters was very sympathetic to Theranos when people were being robbed of billions of dollars on technology that was utterly impossible in this part of the 21st century. So news agencies are just news agencies. They report the news. If some company announces something and he doesn't do it with a crayon and he looks somewhat legit, they repeat what he says. They do not spend their time investigating scientific myths. You know, when Korea came out with the room temperature superconductor, a lot of news agencies just ran with it. When China came out with their nonsensical atomic batteries that would keep your equipment alive for 30 years, they simply republished it. So I think you give the news agencies a lot more credit than they deserve. They inform people of what's being told to people. They don't have the resources to investigate anything, certainly not scientific stuff. You know, none of them have a science degree for the most part.
Information and technology that work, which is science and technology news, and they also show the video of the vehicle. Well, put it this way, there is preliminary information of something taking place. And how it's going to apply, we don't know yet, but at least it's good to know that something like that was tried. There was Japan and Germany that was working on maglev networks, but it is a high cost and the incompatibility of such systems with the existing track infrastructure. So my assumption is that if that technology could be used just for transporting materials like a trolley instead of transporting people, it may have a chance to fly. So I'm going to go more deep into that and eventually come back with some more information. Thank you.
You're welcome, Wesley. I hope they succeed again. There's a lot of things that never get out of research and development for a whole bunch of different reasons. And so, you know, I mean, when I was doing the science talk segment almost every other week, I had something that had to do with good old graphene. And graphene still has not made it into real life commercial items because it is practically impossible to produce in anything other than very teeny tiny little flakes that you can do experiments on. You can't build anything practical that people could take out and use. So a lot of great materials have been discovered, and after, 15, 20 years, we still don't have a clue to manufacture any of it at any cost. So it's problematic. Just because a thing is a wonder material, unfortunately, if we lack the understanding to produce it in large quantities and large surface area and such, it can just be an experimental oddity and something you could write up some papers and maybe get a Nobel Prize if you're lucky. But I more information comes up, you'll let us know.
Yeah, thank you very much. A few words more. The most of the magnetic maglock systems were like something like a rail, and then something hanging below the rail. Here we have a cushion that I assume, because I didn't read the patent. They say it's patented. New way is cryogenic to freeze the magnetic flux. I can't see any other way of doing that and being able to carry only tons with 20,000 kilos. And 1 kilogram is 2 pounds, so 40,000 pounds. Thank you very much. Interesting.
Once again, you're welcome. You mentioned that hoverboard. That hoverboard was kind of just a magic trick. I think they had some superconductors. They had some high powered neodymium magnets, and they had a bath of liquid nitrogen kind of hidden right below the surface to produce the hovering effect. It was impossible to maintain. It was just a nice little public relations thing. Anyway, thank you very much, Wesley. As always, on to our next person, John, N2ZC. I point of giving call signs because in the last four people, we've had John, John, and John. So N2ZC, what's your question for tonight? Okay, I'm trying to give John as much lead time because he's going through Echolink, and we quick ears kind of mess things up for the guys out there using Echolink. So I'll let the repeater drop again. And hopefully John N2ZZ will come back with his question or topic for tonight.
Yeah, good evening, Roy. Thank you. And happy St. Patty's Day to everybody. Just getting back to the black body radiation we spoke about last week, or I think it was 2 weeks ago, forgive me. Sunlight, heat from the sun, which is an incredible distance, and with electromagnetic waves, the power dissipates at an exponential rate with distance. What is the cause of all of this power still being transmitted this far, and, you know, be able to still burn you, etc.? Waiting for your explanation and any kind of critique on my assumptions here.
Okay, this is another good question. The thing that powers the sun is a fusion reaction. The sun is a million plus times more massive than the Earth, and the core is full of hydrogen banging into each other and producing cascades that end up with helium and photons and neutrinos. Neutrinos don't interact with anything, and they travel at the speed of light, and as we talk, trillions of neutrinos are passing through our body and thankfully not doing anything to us. Photons, unfortunately, in the core of the sun bounce back and forth because it's kind of ionized there, and so it takes an immensely long time to get through all that and out of the sun and spreads across the solar system with the inverse square law. So that's what's powering it. If unfortunately you were able to turn off the fusion reaction at the core of the sun, eventually it would stop radiating and cooling down and we'd all die. So it's an immense amount of energy. Way back in the good old days of the science talk, I mentioned that the energy released from the sun is actually lower than the energy released from a human body per kilogram. But because we're not that many kilograms generally, and the sun is a lot of kilograms, that's a lot of energy that's pouring out in all directions. And a small, small fraction of it is hitting the Earth and the years.
Okay, Roy, I'm not going to let you off the hook. I want you to expand a little more on that. That's a very interesting remark that you made there, that the human body has more energy than the sun per kilogram. And what kind of energy are we talking about that we expend, you know, in that relationship? You know, very curious, very interesting fact. And the second thing is the heat that we feel from the sun. Would I be correct to assume that that is in the ultraviolet range? Is that the heat of feeling from the sun in that range?
Well, let me take the second question first, and hopefully the first question, if I remember, to second. No. Most of the ultraviolet is filtered out by the ozone in the atmosphere, and that's why people are frightened if you destroy the ozone layer and expose us to more ultraviolets. Ultraviolet energy is more destructive. It produces radicals which break down cell structure. It increases your risk of skin cancer. And so UV light is not very good for you. That's why you probably should wear some kind of UV blocker if you go out during the summer when the sun is nice and bright. Most of the heat that we feel tends to be in the visible light range. Our body absorbs the different spectrum of light, especially if you wear in black. And also infrared. The sun gives off both visible and invisible light, including infrared, which is probably the most productive of the warmth that you feel on your face when you look up in the general direction of the sun. I forget the first question, so please repeat it, and I'll try and answer that.
Very good explanation on that question. Thank you on that. Yeah, the other question was, you had just briefly mentioned a fact talking about the human body giving off more energy per kilogram than the sun. And, you know, of course, that's quite a statement. And I'm just interested, what kind of energy is that, Roy, that we give off more per kilogram than the sun? What kind of energy is that?
Okay. Well, to kind of make it short, it's thermal energy. Most energy ultimately kind of dissipates into waste heat. So that's where kind of calories come in. Calorie, quantity of water, quantity of degrees centigrade up. So the amount of calories we burn approximately, we're the equivalent of approximately, as far as heat dissipation, 100 watts. So if you take a 100-watt incandescent bulb and you take a human being, they produce about the same amount of thermal waste energy when all the motion and movement and processing and electrochemical reactions, you know, can be settled out and just turned to waste heat. So the energy I'm associating is approximately 100 watts per human being, you know, every second of our lives. So it kind of sounds a little bit like the Matrix, where the artificial intelligence wanted to use human beings as batteries. But there's probably 10 billion better ways of getting power than to just breeding human beings for it.
Very interesting, Roy, it's always very interesting. Thank you for that extra tidbit of information. Okay, I'm going to go back to Matt. I just want to tell you I got another question on transmission lines, but I don't know what your roster consists of, so I'll let you take, you know, whoever's there, of course, and if there's no one else in line or if you have time when everyone else is, I got one more question about transmission lines.
Okay, very good. We'll see. I'll throw it out. I don't have anyone else listed, but you're generous enough to suggest that I throw it out. If anyone else wants to get in line tonight, please hit that push to talk and give me your first name and your call sign.
Okay, Don, Delta Oscar November, and the call sign is November 2, Lima Delta Yankee.
Okay, Don, what's your question tonight?
Okay, so let me see if I can phrase this right. So electrical infrastructure, so I don't know, let's just take a scenario, right? So up in Niagara, right, we have the hydro meters, right, we have solar and all kinds of other stuff that are putting, you know, fossil fuels, power into the transmission lines. Right now, and now you have all these houses, you know, that are sitting there, and you know they have the potential to take the energy that's in the system or in the power line out of it, you know, and use it. But what happens, like, to this power? They're pumping all this power into the transmission line. What happens if it's not being used? What happens to that power?
WB2VAB.
Yep, Ed?
Just letting you know I am here and I have some experience along those lines. Perhaps that question could be clarified a little.
W23Z?
Yeah, W2BZ?
I just put my name on the list, Roy.
Okay, very good. So Don, our resident electrical engineer at WB2EAB is interested in helping you with this question. He would just like you to rephrase it, to focus it a little bit more.
Okay, sure, I'll try. So, I mean, now, you know, you have all these things, you know, pumping the energy into the system, so now I guess you have a potential energy, right, you know, that is in the line. If you're not using this potential energy, right, and you're still pumping it in, like, I'm just curious, you know, how those pumps interact with one another. You know, if you're not using it, you're not, you're still pumping power into it, or does it stop pumping power into it, or, I don't know, just very curious about that. Back to that.
Okay, Ed, is that better phrased? I mean, he really, ultimately he wants to know that, you know, you have this transmission line transmitting massive amounts of energy. What happens if all of a sudden the load kind of is lost and it's just an open wire at the other end rather than a series of loads dissipating the transmission of power?
The answer is four words, the state. New York Power Pool. They have these huge networks with network control centers, almost in a way like air traffic control, controlling airplanes. The power pool controls all of the generators and loads, and they're monitoring what power is going in what direction here to keep the whole thing in balance. And they can order a generating plant to raise or lower their load. Now, some power plants kind of run at fixed load. Others have some variability. Typically, the fossil fuel ones have, you know, variability, almost like stepping on the gas for your car engine. Whereas stuff like hydroelectric and nuclear tend to want to run, you know, full power. Either, you know, full power or completely shut down. But the power pool controls all of this to maintain the entire network in balance. And what happens is, if the network gets out of balance, the voltage starts to go up or down. If you're putting in more power than you're using, the voltage will tend to rise, and they will have, they'll figure out where the current flows are and have certain generators back off. And if the voltage starts to sag, they will have those generators with reserve capacity to increase the power. Does that help?
Yes, indeed. Does it help for you, Don?
Yeah, actually it does. You know, I had always wondered about that, you know, because, like, you have such a big potential here, you know? And I guess, like you said, you know, like if you had, like, the hydropower, you know, plant up in Niagara, that thing just wants to make power and put it into the system, I guess. And now it's there, so now the system has to figure out where to, I guess, direct it. You know, and I'm sure there's all kinds of different ways that thing can be directed. You know, either, you know, I guess in the infrastructure, you know, going out west or. Or down to us, or who knows where, right? Or maybe up into Canada.
It is an incredibly complicated network that is fully, fully monitored. And let me throw out a little fun fact. Back when Indian Point was still operating, which is an interesting subject of it by itself, I was in a training control room, which is a duplicate of the real control room, running exercises, you know, training. Today, ever since Mile Island, nuclear power operators undergo training where they have, you know, all kinds of potential problems thrown at them in simulations to learn what to recognize, what to do about it, what works and what doesn't. But this training room, which duplicates the real one, had one nice big analog gauge from 0 to 2 gigawatts of power, because Indian Point 2 and Indian Point 3 each put out 1.05 gigawatts. And this was for Indian Point 2, and the gauge went from 0 to 2 gigawatts, which is an awful lot of power.
I'm sorry, let me make sure I have it here. I was just chuckling because, like, I was thinking about Michael J. Fox, you know, and the time machine, and what it is, it wanted 1.21 gigawatts. Oh, what's a gigawatt? But yes, I do know what you're talking about, the power plants. I've actually been in to the Port St. Lucie nuclear plant. My brother-in-law actually used to teach there. And I was actually in the training control room, which was an exact copy of the the one, you know, the regular one. So I understand what you're talking about there. Back to you.
You mentioned the future. I did a professional presentation based on that visit to Indian Point. And, like, slide number one was, you know, how do we get gigawatt of power? And I know they call it gigawatts. I actually found a still from the movie on the slide. So, yeah, been there, done that. Oh, and by the way, one other thought. A 1 gigawatt nuclear power plant, like Indian Point, for each gigawatt going to the power lines, would dump over a gigawatt of waste power into the Hudson River. Back to the future, there is no reference to what they do with all that waste power. Now, I know it's science fiction, but I can't help but notice that.
Bravo.
Yeah?
So, are you recognizing Eloy?
Yes, indeed. Over to you.
Another interesting fact, which kind of makes sense intuitively, you think about it, that by connecting generators to the grid, their rotations are linked. I guess via feedback from the alternating current. So there is some self-regulation as well, I believe, in the production of power, where the and everything, you know, all the generators are actually linked rotationally in such a way. I don't know exactly how it works, but I saw that the other day on YouTube, actually, thought it was kind of interesting from a hydroelectric.
You have no idea, Brother Trump. The whole thing is in synchronism. They are synchronous, that the way these generators work is once they're locked in phase, it takes tremendous power to change that. The problem is when you want to put a new generator online, this is very, very delicate work, because you have to have everything lined up perfectly before you close that relay, or you're going to have one humongous explosion.
Yeah, thanks. Roy, I had a question if I was around.
I didn't get that.
I was saying I had a question, though, to Roy. I was telling Roy, this is Kilowatt Zero, Bravo, Bravo. I was telling Roy that I had a question if I'm still around.
I don't know what happened to Roy, but I did hear you. Let's see if he comes back.
I should be back. Yeah, every so often weird things happen with All Star. Yeah, sure, Ryan. I'll put you on the list.
Hey, I'm gonna sign out. But thank you for answering my question. This is Ben Swelly Y. Don here. I guess it was ended up being a very interesting topic. So thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome, Don. Please come back. Utility wires are an interesting variation on the theme of transmission lines. Most of with the RF. Okay, I guess we're done with that question. Next on our list is Rich, W2BZ. What's your question for tonight, Rich?
Okay. Have a mouthful of brown rice. Two questions. First question is, you have an antenna on a tower at 45 feet, an antenna on a tower, a Yagi, at 100 feet. Why is the antenna at 100 feet better than the antenna at 45 feet? That's the first question.
Okay. Well, probably there's going to be someone in the audience who thinks up other reasons. But in my mind, primarily the major two aspects is coupling to earth ground. The higher up you are, the less of the energy is going to couple to earth, and there'll be more energy available for radiation into the ionosphere and the ground waves and such. And also, it's a matter of being high enough to not have any local obstructions, either buildings or hills or or the occasional mountain. So I think that's the two primary reasons why height is usually leads to improvement. And I don't think it's the case that 100% of the time. I'm sure there are special